I'm John Krall. This Sunday marks the start of National Crime Victims' Rights Week. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk not just about the coming week's events, but also what rights victims of crime have and how we can make sure that those rights are respected. My guests are Kelly McBride, Executive Director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, Executive Director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, Victim Assistance Manager with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which starts this Sunday and runs through next Saturday. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kelly McBride, who is the Executive Director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, who is the Executive Director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, who is a Victim Assistance Manager with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. And for our listeners, I want to say this. This is an important conversation. And as you probably are aware, this also is Pledge Week here at WFYI. And I'm sure that you have all been responsive. If you already have and you have already made your pledge, I'd like to say thank you on behalf of WFYI. But if you have not, I would like to ask that you join my wife and me. We have already made our commitment to WFYI and become a sustaining member or a contributor to WFYI. The premise of this program is not difficult to understand. It is a community conversation in which we talk about the things that interest us, that we enjoy, or in some cases, because they are important to our community. And we do that in ways that are not supposed to divide people, to show that we can talk about the tough things in a civil fashion. If you support that, I'd like you to consider making a gift to WFYI. I'm not going to ask you to give until it hurts. I'm going to ask you to give until it feels good. When you are driving around or you are listening outside to this program or any of the many other programs, and there is a subject there that you realize just would not be dealt with anywhere else, I want you to feel some satisfaction that you helped make that possible and smile about it. If you would like to give, you can do so either at WFYI.org or you can call 1-800-233-0020. Again, please give and give until it feels good. Okay, let's talk about National Crime Victims Rights Week. Let's talk a little bit. Kelly, I'm going to start with you. Could you talk really about sort of the genesis of this week?
Certainly.
Long celebration.
So this was first designated by President Ronald Reagan in 1981, and it's an annual observance that seeks to increase the general public awareness of and knowledge about a wide range of rights and services available to people who have been victimized by crime. So several organizations have come together to create public awarenesses surrounding this week. Leading up by the Legacy House, they received a grant that Michael can tell you more about, but there are several different opportunities for engagement coming up.
Okay. Well, Michael, I think that was your cue, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, this is actually the second year in a row that Legacy House has applied for and received a modest grant from the Department of Justice Office of Victims of Crime to put on events to raise awareness, not just about the rights that victims of violence and crime have, but also the resources that are available to those victims in our community. And this year we have four events that are scheduled. The Survivors of Violent Death Support Group, which is a group of family members and friends, mothers, you know, fathers, sisters, brothers of homicide victims, are going to start the week out on Tuesday morning at 10:15 at the Central Library with a memorial display to commemorate the 135 criminal homicides that Indianapolis experienced in 2014. And then that's going to be followed up by Kelly's organization, the Domestic Violence Network, on Wednesday evening is going to be doing a panel discussion also at the Central Library in the auditorium starting at 6 o'clock. Related to media attitudes and how they are media and how the way that sexual assault is portrayed in the media and in community conversations influences the way we look at sexual assault and domestic violence. And then we have the Rockathon on Monument Circle on Thursday at, from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock. We'll be out there with a lot of community resources for victims of violence and for the general public. And that's followed up by a walk. The Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, which is going to be Saturday the 25th at IUPUI on their campus, and that's hosted by the Marion County Center of Hope. And those are the all the hospitals have a Center of Hope, John, that work with victims of domestic and sexual violence, and they're going to be doing the Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, where men actually raise awareness about sexual assault by walking in women's heels.
Oh, I'm not sure I could do that.
We expect to see you there.
I think my hamstrings would start screaming after the first five steps. Lisa, could you talk a little bit? I mean, you know, no one really sort of expects to be in the position of being a crime victim. So when they get to you, I imagine that the learning curve is pretty steep. How do you structure those first conversations and explain to them what their rights are in the process?
First of all, we have to recognize that when I meet people in the community, it's usually the worst day of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's never anything good that's happened. It's something that's really rocked their world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to put myself in their shoes. What would I want? How would I want somebody to interact with me? What would be my concerns, that type of thing. Mainly our mission is really to look at the emotional recovery of victims of crime. That's where Michael and Legacy House come in. We often refer people there, maybe to Kelly's group, just so that they can get some resources for what it is that they need. We look at everybody on an individual basis. There's not... you know, it's not, okay, if it's a homicide, give them this. It's very individual.
And how do you start the conversation, I guess, is where, you know, the premise of my question, because I would think, as you say, it's the worst moment, if not the worst moment, one of the certainly top five or ten worst moments they're likely
Absolutely.
To have in their lives.
One of our first goals is to get to the scene, the actual scene of the crime. And what we found is usually people are pretty open at that point because they're just kind of raw.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to be very gentle and just come in and, you know, we may stand there with them in silence for a little bit just until they feel comfortable with us. You know, we just try to take into account what they've been through. The thing with trauma that we know is that it's not just that event. It's everything that ever happened to them before this point. Trauma is cumulative. So we try to keep that in mind. And we just, you know, just try to go in very gently and let them know, hey, I'm here to help. And if they want our help, we're there for them. If they say no, thank you, we're going to gently step back. And, you know, they have the right to receive services or not.
We are talking about victims' rights in anticipation of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which starts this Sunday. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Dean, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I've been a big fan of Michael Hurst and his work at Legacy House, and it's obvious that the community has benefited greatly from his work there. My question for Michael and your other guests are, how do they maintain such a great level of service with the difficulties and the trauma faced by some of these victims of violence? It just seems to me it takes a special person to be able to consistently maintain service that's being presented. Can they comment on that for me?
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Dean. Michael, I think that was your cue.
Yeah, well, Kelly was nodding, so I wanted her to offer something up. But let me say this. Legacy House, just as an example, provides counseling and advocacy services to victims of violence, and all of our services are provided at free of charge at no cost. And we're funded in such a way through great support from Health and Hospital Corporation to be able to do that. Each of our counselors is, as Lisa said, you know, she's meeting people when they've just experienced the worst day of their life. And each of our counselors are working with those individuals over a long-term basis, helping them unpack the trauma that they've experienced and move from that position of being a victim of violence with all of the dysfunctions that creates in every domain of your life to becoming a survivor, to being able to incorporate it into who you are and working through that on a long-term basis. The really important thing for that counseling relationship is that the counselors themselves maintain healthy boundaries. It's impossible to not take your work home with you, no matter what your job is. But when you're seeing 5 or 6 trauma clients a day, you are taking home with you the trauma that they have unpacked. About a third of our clients, John, are children who've experienced a parade of horribles in their life in either a moment or over a long period of time. So to Dean's question, just the importance of being able to maintain a stable, consistent, high level of service, that really requires the counselors themselves and the other service providers out there to take care of themselves.
How do you, Kelly, at some level, how do you deal with the challenges of something like that? It seems to me that you've got two sort of things that that inherently would hamper any kind of traditional administrative approach. The first is you really can't anticipate what your need is going to be during the course of the year. I mean, we've seen homicide spike mm-hmm. and other kinds of violent crimes seem to be going in different directions in this city right now. But at some level, your most fervent desire is probably to put yourselves out of jobs, to have the problem go away,
right?
So, how do you plan on meeting those kinds of demands and deal with the folks that you have to serve?
Well, like you said, it's very difficult to plan for that in advance. I think it's very important as leaders of organizations that we make sure that our staff is taking care of themselves, that they have self-care. The Domestic Violence Network hosts an advocates retreat once a year for our advocates and those on the front line who are working with these victims of trauma, of homicide, of domestic violence and sexual assault. They see everything every single day. So we take them out of that for one day and we pamper them and we give them massages and we give them pedicures and we make sure that they understand that they've got to take that time out. So that's one of the ways that we can help and support the agencies that are doing this frontline work of making sure that they are taking care of themselves. If they're not taking care of themselves, it doesn't matter what they're doing with their clients, they're not going to be able to serve them properly.
If I may, too.
Yeah.
And that's why National Crime Victim Rights Week provides us with such a great opportunity, because not only are we taking care of the counselors that are working with and the service providers working with clients, but we need to educate the community about who's out there, who are the trauma victims that are out there, what's the trauma that they're experiencing, how is that trauma affecting every domain of their lives, so that if they are in policy-making positions, so for example, in the state legislature right now, there are a number of initiatives that are going through that are responsive to victims of violence, victims of trauma. That's important so that those policy leaders, educating them is important so that they can address things like funding, the funding needs that might be out there, making sure that there aren't gaps in the community and so on.
We are talking about crime victims' rights. National Crime Victims' Rights Week starts next Sunday and continues through the week. There are going to be several events during it. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking about victims' rights. My guests are Kelly McBride, who is the Executive Director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, who is the Executive Director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, who is Victim Assistance Manager with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about victims' rights in anticipation of the start of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which starts on Sunday and will run through the week. My guests are Kelly McBride, who is the executive director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, who is executive director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, who is a victim assistance manager with Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Indianapolis is the one word I screw up out of that. So, and if you believe these kinds of conversations are important, I would urge you to become a sustaining member or to contribute to WFYI. You can do so at WFYI.org, or you can call and make a pledge at 1-800-233-0020. Well, we were talking before the break, the evolution in terms of the timing, this week has been around since 1981, and it was sort of a product. I'm probably dating myself here by explaining that I would understand where this came from. There was a sense starting in the late 60s through the 70s that victims often were forgotten in the process and that somehow a balance had to be restored here. I'd like to ask each of you to comment on whether we have achieved that balance yet or if there is still work that needs to be done. Lisa, I'll start with you.
I think that we've come a long way, but I think that we still have some work to do. Last night we had our Survivors of Violent Death support group, and some of the members were saying that, they felt like the defendant had more rights than they did. And that's something that resonates with me. I think that we definitely have a ways to go. But like I said, we have come a long way.
Michael.
Well, I kind of come at it from both a personal and a professional standpoint. In 1970, my brother was the victim of a homicide. And although it was a long time ago, but it offers me a perspective that unfortunately too many people also have. But I grew up in a family that was impacted by a criminal homicide, and I remember, even though I was 9 years old, 10 years old, 11 years old, I remember the police investigation process. I remember the community conversation that surrounded my brother's homicide. I remember the vicious letters to the editor that were published in the local newspaper, and some of the things that my parents would say when they would come back from each day of the trial proceedings about what was happening in the trial. All of those things were happening in an environment where there really weren't any rights that were available to my family, to my parents. There really weren't any services that were available to us at that time. So I can also appreciate now professionally, both in federal law and in state law, Indiana has a dozen or more statutes that are very focused on making sure that victims of violent crime have rights. They have rights to compensation. They have rights to notice of hearings. They have rights to be notified when individuals who are incarcerated are going to be released. And there are a number of rights that exist today, John, that didn't exist before. So I appreciate what Lisa's saying. I agree with what Lisa's saying. But I think the biggest thing we need to do in terms of how far we go is to raise awareness and change the culture with all of the people that touch victims about the existence of these rights and how they can be better afforded.
Kelly.
So my expertise is domestic violence and sexual assault, and I think it's wonderful that we have these legal rights for victims, and we have come quite a long way, but it also starts with believing the victim. So if a victim of sexual assault or domestic violence discloses to you, that you believe that person and you meet them where they are, that's the first step. And if we can't get to that step, then all those legalities, they don't really even matter at that point. So as a community, we need to come together and stop victim blaming, stop saying, well, that 12-year-old knew what she was doing when she was having sex with a 23-year-old, and start calling it, well, that 23-year-old raped that 12-year-old. So it's changing that whole conversation as well.
And I've done a fair amount of reporting on both the problems of rape and sexual assault and also domestic violence. It seems to me that there's another challenge specific to that, and that is that those are also subjects that for a long time we just did not want to talk about. It got beyond whether we believed or didn't believe.
Right.
It was, well, even if it's true, we don't want to think about that.
Right. It happens behind closed doors was the mentality, and still is to a point.
And does that make the challenge even greater to sort of protect or at least support the victim? I was throwing it to Kelly, but I could see Lisa indicating that she might have something she wants to say there. So I'm going to throw it Lisa's way.
You know, I think Kelly's absolutely right in that, you know, we have to start believing. But I think you hit on a nerve for me. You know,
I hope not unpleasant.
Oh, no. No,
okay.
No.
Okay.
Just that, you know, we have to talk about these things. It's not pleasant, but it happens. And by not talking about it, that kind of puts the victim in a position to where they think, you know what, I'm alone. And they're not alone. Mm-hmm. So we have to start talking about it, even though, you know, it's not pleasant. We have to start that conversation.
We are talking about victims' rights in anticipation of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which starts this Sunday. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Allison, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to call and talk about maybe a slightly different victim that maybe doesn't get thought about. But I found myself calling the Victims Assistant Unit at IMPD last spring after my son had intervened on a friend of his who was trying to commit suicide. And when my son couldn't convince him not to, he left. He called the police, and when the police arrived and knocked on the door, this young man shot himself to death. And so my son and his 17-year-old friend were in a way victims of having been the last one on the scene to hear this violent act. Thankfully they didn't witness it, and they were asked to stay for a couple of hours after the incident, but were never really questioned by the police. And they really came home traumatized. Mm-hmm. And so when I called to say, well, you know, where can they process this? They, of course, you know, felt that the police had mishandled it, their young kids. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But there were no resources to help the bystander of someone who had been involved in trying to prevent an act of violence and was unsuccessful and had to witness it. So I understand resources are really, really, really tight, but I guess my story speaks to just how the ripple impact that crime and violence can have just beyond the immediate victim and family.
Mm-hmm. Allison, I am sorry, obviously, that your son and your family went through that, and I thank you for calling in and sharing your story with us.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I always wonder if that's even on anybody's kind of radar screen about thinking about broader community healing and kind of just that next step removed. I mean, they weren't related to this boy. The parents were obviously kind of the subject of interest, and understandably. But
Allison, I apologize.
I hope my kids are okay.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
This is Lisa. I apologize, sure. Allison. Let me tell you that is very much on our radar. And for somebody like your son, we would want to refer them to someplace like Legacy House. Legacy House was actually started due to secondary victim trauma. And they would be the perfect people for your son to talk to. They are free of charge. I'm probably their biggest cheerleader.
We appreciate that.
Yeah. But, yeah, that would be someplace that we would refer to them. I'm not sure who you spoke with in our office, but I do apologize for that.
Well, and let me take Allison's question, what I thought was the broader one. Do we sort of define the impact of violent crime and the sort of nature of victimhood far too narrowly here? I mean, there are reasons, for example, if someone steals my wallet, it's not my responsibility to go out and achieve justice on that. We see that as a crime against society, and therefore we all take on responsibility for dealing with it. Do we lose that sense a bit when we're talking about that a violent act like that can have, as she said, ripples that go out much wider than the immediate impact point?
Absolutely. I think, and I took that point as well. One of the things that I often say is if we too narrowly define what a victim of violence is, if we're just looking at the individual who was battered as an example and don't look at the family members who witnessed the battering, if we don't look at the first responders who time and time and time again respond to violence, if we don't look at the broader community and how it's reacting, then we're doing ourselves as a community a great injustice. 135 individuals were victims of criminal homicide in Indianapolis, Indiana in 2014. And that has a huge community impact on how we perceive the safety of our city, whether or not we're going to go to certain areas of the city and so on. Also, when we start to expect violence, John, we start to accept it. And when we start to accept it, we become insensitive to it. It no longer seems like it's a big deal in our community. The front page story about the quadruple homicide might end up on the third page of the newspaper or the third story in the news because it's just something that becomes part of the fabric of our community. So we absolutely need to be thinking about community healing, family healing, and Allison is certainly right, and I appreciate Lisa's comment. At Legacy House, we deal with all kinds of violence, and we work with secondary victims, and we work with tertiary victims, the first responders as well. We are a home for addressing trauma.
Well, and Kelly, I would think that it'd have particular relevance for, in regard to domestic violence, because, assuming that it's a situation in which a spouse is being abused, often there are witnesses within the family to that, to children. Even if they're not immediately the subject of the violence themselves, witnessing it can have tremendously traumatic effect on them as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we know research shows us that children who grow up in a household where there is domestic violence, that they are more likely to become batterers or more likely to become victims themselves, and that peace starts in the home and violence starts in the home. So if that's what you learn in the home, that's what your community is going to have. So when we have this violence spreading into our streets, it's starting at home. So we've got to get in front of our kids, teach them what a healthy relationship looks like, And then get in front of their parents, too, so that they can look for the warning signs for teen dating violence or in bullying. There's a huge correlation between bullying and domestic violence as adults. And even when Michael was talking and my mind wandered to an incident I just read, not here in Indy, it was in Florida over spring break, that hundreds of bystanders watched as a woman was gang raped by two or three men. And to me, that's so sickening that hundreds of people and no one stood up to protect this woman who was incapacitated. She was passed out and being violated in broad daylight. What does that say about us as a society at this point, and how do we change that?
We are talking about crime victims' rights in anticipation of National Crime Victims' Rights Week. You can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what Richard has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
My mind is, wouldn't it be great if we could prevent some of this? And do your people that work in this field have any ideas what myself or others could do for intervention to prevent some of this from happening?
Great question, and right on point, Richard. Thanks very much for the call. I'll throw that one to Kelly first.
Thanks. Yes. Yes. You can help prevent it. So many times, I mean, just the example I just gave is stepping up. And even if your voice shakes, to be able to say, you know, that's not okay. You can't do that. Teaching your kids boundaries and what consent means. You can teach a child consent starting at the age of birth. And just that leading along the way, you can definitely sit down and have coffee with any three of us, and we can give you, you know, specific examples of how you and your life can do this. But just being an upstander and a bystander and calling out those people in your life who are violent or have tendencies in that direction.
The Active Bystander Initiative is actually a big part. You'll see it nationally with the No More campaign, and you've probably seen the commercials. Mm-hmm. In various sporting events, or the It's On Us campaign regarding sexual assault. And we talk about it in terms of being an active bystander, intervening when we see a situation arising that could turn into a specific act of criminal conduct.
Well, I have a great bystander story real fast. So I was in a conference last week in New Orleans with some coworkers, and after the conference, we were, you know, maybe having water on a balcony and saw a man throw a woman against the wall. And the next thing I hear were several people yelling, "Get your hands off of her right now." And that just diverted the entire situation, where then half the group went to him, half the group went to her. And that was a great example of being a bystander, of not letting that happen. You saw it, knew it was wrong, stepped in.
It's important to say be safe when we're I'm sorry, I just...
No, go ahead, Michael.
I felt that was really important to do is you also want to look out for your own safety when you're doing that, but you can be an active bystander in a variety of ways.
Well, and use your cell phone in that case. In addition to yelling 911
exactly.
is a handy number.
Exactly. Lisa. Yeah, I was just going to echo, sometimes intervening is just calling 911.
And letting them step in.
Absolutely.
I've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Gary. He says, "I feel it is necessary to ask the question, have any of the individuals any knowledge of persons having to accept false statements or portrayals in order for a person to continue being the victim?" Basically, you know, do victims make stuff up? The silence is overwhelming here.
I think we all have answers to that, and Kelly might be able to speak in specific percentages, but there is such a small percentage, 2-3%, I think, is the number of sexual assaults that are false reports of sexual assault. We all come from a perspective of ensuring that victims of violence have safety, have continued safety, and engage in a healing process. And the very first thing we all need to do when we're encountering a victim of violence is believe them. We have to start by believing the victim and move from there.
Kelly, 2-3%, that's the number I have always heard before. And in most of those cases, it can be relatively easily verified, right?
Absolutely.
We are talking about National Crime Victims' Rights Week here on No Limits. It starts this Sunday and runs through the week. My guests are Kelly McBride, who's the executive director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, who is executive director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, who is victim assistance manager with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the rights of victims of crime in anticipation of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which starts this coming Sunday and runs through the week. My guests are Kelly McBride, who is the executive director of the Domestic Violence Network, Michael Hurst, who is executive director of Legacy House, and Lisa Brown, who is victim assistance manager with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. If you believe conversations like this are important, I would encourage you to do what my wife and I have already done, and that is give to WFYI. You can do so by going to the website, WFYI.org, or you can call and say, call 1-800-233-0020. You can tell them John sent you, and, you know, give until it feels good. We are talking again about victims' rights, and at the break we were talking a little bit about the perception that sometimes people, victims, make up stories. Kind of knocked that one down, said it's a very rare occurrence. What are some of the other myths or misperceptions about victims of crime? Michael, I'll go with you first.
Wow. Well, I think all three of us would jump on as kind of a first thing. We tend to want to blame victims. So we, you know, I was talking to Kelly earlier about this. We all want to feel safe. We want to feel safe in our skins and in our homes and in our communities. And whenever we hear about a crime, whether it's sexual assault or domestic violence or homicide, our immediate reaction, I think, is to try to figure out how that could never happen to us. There must, some, that victim must have been doing something that engendered that experience of violence. And I think we talk about it that way, John, but I also think that is a huge myth of how we look at victimization.
Mm-hmm. We all want to create that illusion of safety.
Yes.
That may or may not be there. We are talking about victims' rights here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Jackie, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I appreciate all the things that you're covering. One of the things I wanted to ask, and I can keep it simple or I can elaborate, but basically I wanted to ask, what would you say has to do with nurture versus nature? My brother and I, while we're not biologically related, we were raised in the same household. Our parents are both retired Presbyterian ministers, worked in the mental health field. And I found out later in my life that my brother was repeatedly raped by a young man on the bus that he shared going to school. We were 4 years apart, so I was not in the same group with him, so I was not really able to protect him. I lived in the same house. I had the same parents, the same experiences, and my cup is always overflowing, and his cup is never half full. And I don't know how to wrap my brain around helping him. Obviously, he's been in counseling. He works in the mental health field. So basically, that's it. I'm just curious if there's been any research or insight into nurture versus nature when it comes to victimization. Thank you.
Jackie, thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story. And our thoughts go out to your brother. Thank you. Well, I'll start probably with Lisa. No, she's throwing it to Michael. She just threw him under the bus. So, Michael, we're going to you.
Jackie, there's a huge bank of research that goes back now a couple of dozen years on adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. You see it all the time. As a matter of fact, NPR ran a huge series on it probably 4 or 5 weeks ago. And the idea is that the more adverse childhood experiences individuals have as they're growing up, the more likely it is that those individuals as adults are going to have ongoing issues, whether they're medical issues or trauma-related issues, mental health issues, and so on. And so you kind of described a situation in which your brother experienced some pretty horrific adverse childhood experiences that he's carrying with him, he's continuing to carry with him, and there's this incredible body of research that says this is exactly what we expect to have happen when a child is growing up in poverty, when a child is growing up in homelessness, when a child is growing up in a domestic violence situation or any other kind of traumatic experience. And so what he's been doing, certainly getting counseling and other help, is important, but it can be directly traced back to those experiences.
What, you know, let me take it a step, Jackie's question a step further here. What if, you know, the horrible happens, that illusion of safety is shattered and someone in your family, a friend, a neighbor, a coworker, you know, someone you know, becomes a victim of a crime, particularly a violent crime. What are the things you can do to help in the aftermath? I'll start with Lisa, since it sounds like she's pretty much the first responder here, then go to Kelly and then go to Michael.
I think the first thing is not to use language that blames the victim. What were you doing out at 2 in the morning? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Why were you wearing that? Anything that would imply that the victim was at fault, you know, that the victim asked for this because the victim didn't ask for that. I think just watching what you say, I'm going back to our Survivors of Violent Death support group last night. Sometimes they get on these topics about helpful things that, well, so-called helpful things that people have said, like, oh, they're in a better place. That's not helpful. I think if you don't know what to say, don't say anything. You know, just give a hug. I'm so sorry that this happened to you. That type of thing, it less is more, I believe.
Kelly.
Listening, I think, is key, is listening more than talking. Being there for that person and understanding that the behavior that comes after from that person might be crazy and erratic or completely normal. There's no mold that a victim fits into. So if trauma happens, they could go right on with their life, and that does not mean that trauma didn't happen, or they could maybe start drinking heavily. There's just no perfect mold of what that looks like. So being there and meeting that person where they are, and I would certainly say refer them to the Legacy House.
Okay.
I like what Lisa said at the top of the program, where she said just be a quiet presence. Sometimes mm-hmm. the value of being a quiet presence to a trauma victim can't be overstated. And then, of course, listening to understand instead of listening to react or listening mm-hmm. to respond. Trauma victims have to unpack the trauma that they're experiencing. You know, help them relax, be patient, be calm, mm-hmm. be the stable influence in their life, because what they're talking about, what they've experienced, is anything but stable.
What I've heard, a wise man, a mentor of mine once said that, you know, when something horrible happens to someone you know, about the only important thing you can say to that person is, I care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know, at the heart of it. So I guess my next question then is, you know, and I don't know any other way to frame this, but what constitutes success when we're trying to deal with victims? I mean, presumably, you know, some forms of grief, obviously, they just become an ongoing part of your life. And that's it. The metaphor I often use is that it's like an island in the river of your life, and the water may continue to flow around it, but the island's still going to be there. You know, what constitutes success in helping victims of crimes deal with the trauma? Michael, I'll go with you first.
Yeah, it's not what you'd expect. I think we all look for the burning bush, this big splash of something that's success, but it could be something as simple as the individual is able to get out of bed mm-hmm. again.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something as simple as the individual is able to go to work and work a full day without having to come home experiencing anxiety and other kinds of symptoms. At Legacy House, we kind of take a measurement, how are you feeling in terms of what are your trauma-related symptoms that you're experiencing when you first come in to see us? And then each time we make an assessment about your level of trauma-related symptoms. Are you still having nightmares? What's the nature of your nightmare? Are you still sleeping in with the lights on all the time? Are you still checking every single cabinet and every single door in the house? We look at just how people are able to stop doing some of those things over a period of time that they were doing after their first experiencing being a victim. And that's not what a lot of people think about when they think about success. They expect there to be some bright line. Aren't you over this yet? Shouldn't there be closure? You're past the trial. You're past this anniversary. Shouldn't things be different for you yet? And success for those individuals tends to be smaller, John.
Kelly.
I just mirror exactly what Michael just said. It's so individualized. There is no way to measure it except working with that individual and on that individual basis. But it's important for the general population to know, especially when they have a loved one who's experienced. There is no timeline the grief could go on forever, or they could be fine the next day. That you really just have to work with them and where they are.
And that part, it sounds like, from what I'm picking up from the three of you too, since you want to be careful about judging a person's resilience, too,
mm-hmm,
in terms. It's not just about, blaming the victim, but also saying, okay, shouldn't you be able to get past this by now?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. That's one of
Lisa.
The most damaging things that you can say. Aren't you over this yet? There are certain things that you're never going to get over. In our support group, we talk about getting through something as opposed to getting over. Getting over implies that, just that. It's done. It's in the past. Getting through it, particularly with a family of a homicide victim, to get through it means, okay, I'm going to work. I'm paying the bills. I'm pushing on. But they still carry that grief with them. Mm-hmm. I think one of the best things that you can do if you're trying to support somebody that's been a crime victim is don't judge. And don't make assumptions. Aren't you over that yet? Some things you never get over.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about victims' rights here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
I'm a former prosecutor and worked a great many sexual assault cases. And just believe me, this is not an exercise in victim blaming, because sexual assault victims they have such deep wounds that last forever, and I've seen it firsthand. But one of the difficulties, I think, in the prosecution of sexual assault cases, especially in my experience, which has been at, I was a prosecutor in a county with a large college, with a large university. And one of the difficulties is that at the very beginning, for a lot of different reasons that don't really matter, but at the very beginning, often co-eds don't give all of the facts. Most of which is because they're embarrassed, and it's such an invasive process. But what that does is it makes it easier for defense attorneys to make them look like liars. And so I think the message is, if ever you're counseling someone who is in that situation, the thing to do is just to tell the complete and full truth at the very beginning, and that will absolutely help you get justice. It won't change the deep psychological and maybe physical scars that you'll have, but it will at least aid in the process of getting justice.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Andrew. Lisa, I'm going to throw that to you, because I think that's one of the kinds of conversations you have to have.
And I
could see you grimacing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Andrew. And that's something that we do talk about when we're on the scene of a sexual assault, or particularly on the way to the drive to the hospital, is we'll explain. Please tell the detective everything. If you were drinking, smoking pot, whatever, you know, tell them everything so that a defense attorney can't, you know, discredit you. And that is something that we talk about.
Is making sure that they have complete possession of the facts. Is there resistance to that? Because, you know, and
there can
because
be.
Because, you know, he used the word embarrassment, at least in my reporting,
yeah.
You know, over the years. The word that often comes up is a sense of shame. Almost.
Right, right.
It goes beyond embarrass. Embarrass, right. You can get past.
Absolutely.
Shame, humiliation's a little harder.
That's one of the benefits of having us right on the scene.
Yeah.
So that we can talk with those victims and say, you know what, we've heard everything. Mm. Nothing that you say to us can shock us. This doesn't have anything to do with you. You were the victim. You didn't have control over this. This was done to you. So, you know, please help us help you. And, you know, just explaining, please tell us everything. I think that that's critical that we get to the scene as soon as possible and start working with the victim right away.
I'd hate to leave this program without giving people, if they are, you know, confronting some of the issues we're talking about, you know, if they're victims or whatever, not give them a way to call for help. So I would like, you know, if you are a victim of a crime and you want assistance, Lisa, how should they reach out to you to get that help?
You know what? They can call the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, the Victim Assistance Unit. That number is 317-327-3331.
Go ahead and give it to them again.
317-327-3331. Any of our staff can help you. If you would prefer, you can speak with me directly. I'd be happy to talk to you and make a referral.
Kelly, I'm going to go with you next. If people want to reach out if they're in a situation in which domestic violence is occurring, mm-hmm. what's the step they should take?
They can absolutely reach out to us. We do not work directly with victims or perpetrators of domestic violence or sexual assault, but those who actually do. So we do a lot of prevention and outreach. So I would refer them to Michael Legacy House or the Julian Center, or they can always call 211. If they're in immediate danger, always call 911.
Okay. Michael.
And at Legacy House for trauma counseling purposes, and again, all of our services are free of charge. Our call number is 554-5272, and again, that's...
Go ahead and give them it again.
554-5272. We'll just ask you a few questions about the trauma that you experienced and get you assigned to a counselor.
And in that process, when you say a few questions, I mean, you know, if they're making you hurried in a difficult situation or they're embarrassed, is that conversation a 10-minute conversation or an hour-long conversation?
It can be a 5-minute conversation or an hour conversation, depending on the caller's needs.
Well, I would like to thank all of you for taking part in this conversation. I'd like to thank all of our listeners as well who called in and shared their stories, brought the questions. I think it was a very important conversation. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Certainly. And if all of you believe that this was an important conversation, conversations like this matter, again, I would urge you to give to WFYI. You can do so at WFYI.org. or at 1-800-233-0020. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.